And he's got a burdensome message to bring. And so we have in chapters 13 and 14 the burden of Babylon, which is essentially God's message of judgment against Babylon. In chapter 14 and verse 29, we have a brief one. Doesn't mention the word burden in there, but it talks about Palestina, which actually means the Philistines, Philistia. They are mentioned in the closing four verses of chapter 14. Then in chapter 15, the burden of Moab, and a prophecy against Moab there, and that continues on through chapter 16. Then chapter 17, the burden of Damascus, which was the capital of the nation of Syria. So this is reference to Syria, and that seems to go on through chapter 18. So we've got two chapters on Babylon, with a brief prophecy about the Philistines at the end of chapter 14. Then we have chapters 15 and 16 are about Moab. Then 17 and 18 about Damascus, or Syria. Then chapter 19 and 20 are about Egypt, or the burden of Egypt. Now, chapter 20 also introduces Ethiopia, but Egypt is still being discussed also. Egypt and Ethiopia are under discussion in chapter 20. And then in chapter 21, it's hard to know who is in mind here. There's quite a few shorter burdens. The first one in chapter 21 says the burden of the desert of the sea. Now, the burden of the desert of the sea, it's not clear who that's about, except that the desert of the sea apparently was an Assyrian term for Babylonia. Now, we'll talk about that more later. Chapter 21, verse 11 is the burden of Duma, which is the capital of Edom. Edom, the Edomites come under a short prophecy of destruction there. Then verse 13, the burden of upon Arabia. And that takes up the rest of chapter 21. Then chapter 22 is the burden of the Valley of Vision. Again, that's a little hard to define, but generally considered to refer to the Valley of Hinnom, which is outside Jerusalem. And definitely the latter part of the chapter deals with political matters inside Jerusalem. Prophesying about two men, Shebna and Eliakim, and their political posts they hold in Jerusalem. So chapter 22 would apparently have to do with Jerusalem. And then chapter 23 is the burden of Tyre. So you can see that with the exception of the one that's a burden of Jerusalem, or related to Jerusalem, chapter 22, all these chapters are prophecies against the nations, the Gentile nations. Now, a lot of them are very repetitious. None of them are very positive. They're all burdens. And they're kind of a drag to read through them, to tell you the truth. And part of the reason that they're a drag to read through is that in some cases we don't know, and we can't know, how they were fulfilled. We just don't know enough about what was meant by the wording of the prophecy or the historic detail of how these nations met their doom. But one thing is clear, all of these prophecies are messages of doom to those nations which have at one time or another been enemies of God's people, or as in the case of Babylon would soon be. Now, what I want to take today in the remaining time is chapters 13 and 14, which is prophecy against Babylon. It's interesting that Babylon would come up here because Isaiah lived a good time before the Babylonian captivity, some 150 years or so before the Babylonian captivity. And at this time when Isaiah spoke, Babylon was not a significant threat. In Isaiah's day, it was Assyria that was eating up the world politically and militarily. But Babylon later would, and Isaiah, by prophetic insight, sees Babylon's role, and also sees into the future the fall of Babylon. And mostly this is a prophecy about the overthrow of Babylon. Now, even though Babylon wasn't the major threat at this time, it was still a great nation. I mean, the city of Babylon was very, very powerful. It had great walls around it. To speak of it falling would be to speak of something that the odds are against it. But the prophecy sees very clearly things that really did happen to Babylon later. Now, we can learn some very important things from these two chapters also, as you'll see. The burden of Babylon, chapter 13, verse 1, which Isaiah the son of Amoz did see. Lift ye up a banner upon the high mountain. Exalt the voice to them. Shake the hand, that they may go into the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my sanctified ones. I have also called my mighty ones for my anger, even them that rejoice in my highness. The noise of a multitude in the mountains, like as of a great people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts mustereth the host of the battle. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven, even the Lord and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. Now, this is the burden against Babylon. And therefore it is talking about what's going to happen to Babylon when God brings his judgment. He talks about how God beckons with his hand. Verse 2 says, shake the hand. Actually, the Jerusalem Bible clarifies it, beckon with the hand. That is, call for, you know, motion for them to come. Who? The enemies of Babylon are called. And these would be the Persians, as history bears out. The Media Persian Empire came and destroyed Babylon. Interestingly, he speaks in verse 3 of these Persian armies as God's sanctified ones, also his mighty ones. Now notice he calls them his armies. And in verse 5 he says, the Lord and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. That is, these Persians, though they were not Christian, and they were not Jews, and they were not devout for the God of Israel, yet they were God's instrument. They were his weapons of indignation. They were his sanctified ones. And sanctified here means, of course, set apart. God had set them apart for this purpose. And we can see later on in Isaiah 44 and 45 that Cyrus, the commander of the Persians who conquered Babylon, is called God's own chosen shepherd. Yeah, I mean, he wasn't even a godly man, but he was used by God to accomplish his purposes in overthrowing Babylon. So it's interesting to see God speaking of a heathen army as his weapons and his sanctified ones. In fact, Jesus, in the parable of the wedding feast, where the Jews are depicted as people, guests who refuse the invitation, Jesus said in that parable, therefore the king was angry and sent out his armies to burn down their city. Well, that's a reference to what happened in 70 AD when the Romans came and burned down Jerusalem. But interestingly, Jesus in the parable says the king sent his armies. The king in the parable is God. And therefore, he's suggesting that the Roman armies, impious and heathen as they were, nonetheless were God's armies on that occasion to bring his judgment. And that is something we have to understand from the scriptures. Both the Old and the New Testament teach that war is used by God, even though many times the people that he uses are not on his side either. I mean, it's not as though the Persians honored God. It's just that he used them, and so they were the weapons of his indignation. Even as Assyria had been his weapons of indignation against Israel in an earlier prophecy in chapter 10. Verse 6 addresses the Babylonians and says, howl ye, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It shall come as a destruction from the Almighty. Now, it really came through the Persians, but it's to be viewed as something coming from God. Therefore shall all hands be faint, and every man's heart shall melt, and they shall be afraid. Pangs and sorrows shall take hold of them. They shall be in pain as a woman that travaileth. They shall be amazed one at another. Their faces shall be as flames. Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, both cruel and with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. And I will punish the world for their evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. And I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease, and I will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. I will make a man more precious than fine gold. That is rare. People will be killed in so great numbers that to find a survivor will be as rare as finding gold. Even a man than the golden wedge of Ophir. Therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall remove out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts and in the day of his fierce anger. And it shall be as the chased roe, that is a deer that's being pursued by a hunter, and as a sheep that no man taketh up, they shall be every man turned to his own people and flee every one into his own land. Now, there's a bit of a problem in the interpretation of this, because when you get to a verse like 9, it says God, his wrath is going to be, he's going to destroy the sinners. The day of the Lord cometh cruel with both wrath and fierce anger. To lay the land desolate, he shall destroy the sinners out of it. Now, in the context, it sounds like the land involved is Babylon. I mean, he's talking about this is the burden of Babylon. This is the judgment that's going to happen to Babylon. And it sounds like he's talking about destroying the sinners in Babylon. But then he says in verse 10, for the stars of the heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. And I will punish the world for their evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. And I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease, and I will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. Now, it sounds there that he's kind of shifted gears there, and he's looking beyond the destruction of Babylon to the end of the world, where he's going to judge the world, and the stars and the sun and so forth are going to be, that's the end of them. And so some have understood it that way, that in the midst of the prophecy against Babylon, the prophet momentarily, without warning, shifts his view to times thousands of years later to the end of the world. And perhaps maybe because he sees the day of the Lord that comes upon Babylon as sort of a type and a shadow of the ultimate day of the Lord that will come on the whole earth. That is a possible interpretation, and I will not refute it. I mean, I think it's a very reasonable consideration. There are some problems with it. They're not the greatest in the world, but there are some problems. For instance, if that's what he's talking about, he must have at least returned to his original subject when he says in verse 14, they shall every man turn to his own people and flee everyone to his own land, because that would seem to mean if he's talking about the end of the world, how are people going to flee to their own land after God's destroyed the world? What land are they going to flee to? It sounds more like the destruction of Babylon, that verse, because what happened and what's being depicted here is when the Persians conquered Babylon, they allowed those expatriated peoples who had been taken into captivity by Babylon, the Persians allowed them to all go back to their own lands. And the Jews were among them and went back to Jerusalem. I mean, that was just the policy of Cyrus and of the early kings of Persia, that they let the people who had been taken captive in Babylon, they let them go to their own lands. And here it talks about when Babylon falls, everyone goes to their own land. It sounds more like the fall of Babylon than the end of the world in that particular phrase. So if there is a discussion of the end of the world in verse 10, for instance, then we would have to say it was a brief glimpse from which he turns away quickly and gets back to his main subject of Babylon. Now there's another possibility. And this, not everyone will be able to appreciate this or accept it, and that's okay. But there is such a thing as apocalyptic language in the Scripture. Certain books like Daniel and Revelation are what scholars call apocalypses. In fact, the book of Revelation is called the Apocalypse in the Greek. That's the Greek name of the book, the Apocalypse. An apocalypse is a piece of writing in a certain literary genre, in a certain style. And we have very much knowledge of apocalypses because many Jewish apocalypses that were not biblical, I mean like written by Jews but they weren't inspired, are existent and have been studied by scholars. And these books all have some things in common, like the way they describe things. They will discuss very frequently the fall of an empire in terms like this. The fall of a great nation is described in terms of the sun and the moon and the stars falling out of the sky. Now, obviously, when Babylon fell, the sun and the moon and the stars weren't literally darkened. Yet we will find, as we read attentively the Old Testament, that very frequently such language is used to describe the fall of various nations, including Edom and Egypt and others. Now, I don't have all the references at my fingertips that I wish I had, but let me take, for instance, chapter 34 of Isaiah. Isaiah 34 and verse 4. Now, there's difference of opinion. Some people think this has to do with the end of the world also. But in it, there is a reference to God judging Edom. And so some believe that this is about the fall of Edom. In, for instance, chapter 34, verse 5 says, "My sword shall be bathed in heaven. Behold, it shall come down upon Idumea," which is another word for Edom, "and upon the people of my curse." Also, Idumea is mentioned in verse 6 at the end, with the fat of the kidneys, and a great slaughter in the land of Idumea, or Edom. Now, this could be a prophecy about the fall of Edom, as it appears to be, or some think Edom just represents all God's enemies, as could be the case. But notice verse 4, "And all the hosts of heaven shall be dissolved. The heaven shall be rolled together as a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down as the leaf falleth off the vine, as the falling fig from the fig tree." Now, this language could be symbolic. In other words, the fall of a great nation is seen to have an import comparable to that of the fall of the heavenly bodies. Things that one would think would never collapse, like Babylon. Things you'd think would be there for ages. You know, things that you consider to be faithful and trustworthy and always present. If they fall, you know, it's as little anticipated as if the sun would darken or as if the stars would fall. Now, this kind of language is used very frequently in the Old Testament. Let me show you, for instance, Ezekiel 32, just one other case. There are some others, but I don't have the time. I'm trying to keep my one eye on the watch here. Ezekiel 32, which is a prophecy against Pharaoh or Egypt. Okay, this is Ezekiel's version of the burdens of the nations, and this is against Egypt. And it says in Ezekiel 32, 7 and 8, "And when I shall put thee out," that is Egypt, "I will cover the heaven and make the stars thereof dark. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give her light. And all the bright lights of heaven will I make dark over thee, and set darkness upon thy land, saith the Lord God." Now, again, that's said to take place when God judged Egypt. Well, did those things literally happen? I don't believe so. I don't believe that all the stars and the sun were darkened when Egypt fell, or when Babylon fell, or when Edom fell. But there is some reason to believe that that language is used in a non-literal way. And you know that Jesus used the same language in the Olivet Discourse, where he talked about the sun shall be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall. And when we get to that in Matthew 24, I'll point out to you that the context would suggest he may have been using that in a non-literal way too, just like the other prophets before him did. So an alternative here is to see this is not a glimpse of the end of the world in the midst of a prophecy against Babylon, but simply a continuation of his prophecy against Babylon, but using graphic apocalyptic images such as we find in various other parts of the Bible to speak of things that have not literally happened at that time, but which just, I mean, it's just, it's Jewish figurative apocalyptic language. So if, you know, if you don't care for that particular interpretation, you can leave it behind and just say, well, we've got a glimpse of the end of the world here, and you can take it either way. But let's go on. Verse 15 now. Isaiah 13:15. Everyone that is found shall be thrust through, and everyone that is joined unto them shall fall by the sword. That is, everyone who is an ally of Babylon will be wiped out. Their children also shall be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses shall be spoiled, and their wives raped, ravished. Now this is basically what always happened in those days. When a Middle Eastern barbarian nation conquered another, they would almost always rape the women and dash the babies against the stones. This is exactly, in fact, what Babylon had done to Jerusalem. When they conquered Jerusalem, they did this very thing. And you find in Psalm 137, a psalm that was written by a Jew who had experienced this, by a Jew who was in Jerusalem when the Babylonians conquered it. And he had seen the Babylonians rape the Jewish women. He'd seen the Babylonian armies dash the babies against the stones. And now he finds himself among the captives in Babylon, and he writes this short lament, which is Psalm 137. And the writer says, by the rivers of Babylon, that there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. You know, when we remembered Jerusalem, we wept. Because here we are now sitting down in Babylon as captives. And we wept when we remembered home. And we hanged our harps upon the willows. That is, we don't celebrate anymore. We hung up our harps in the midst thereof. For they that carried us away captive, meaning the Babylonians, required of us a song. And they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of those songs of Zion we've heard so much about. But we say, how shall we sing the Lord's songs in a strange land? Then he says, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. Then he prays for judgment on Babylon. He says, remember, O Lord, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, that they were confederate with Babylon on that occasion, who said, raise it, even the foundation thereof, that is, burn it down. O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed? Happy shall he be that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stones. Now that verse stumbles a lot of people when they read that. When to have a man inspired by the Holy Spirit saying, happy shall he be who dashes your little ones against the stones. This is not expressing a hatred for the babies of Babylon. What it is expressing is a cry for justice and for vengeance upon Babylon, that God would give exact justice to that nation, and that the exact thing they had done to others would be eventually done to them. And that is what we read in Isaiah 13, which was written, by the way, many centuries before that psalm was written. Isaiah wrote these words. It says, their children shall be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses shall be ransacked, and their wives shall be ravished. And then going on to verse 17, behold, I will stir up the Medes. Now this identifies the ones that God is going to use to destroy Babylon, the Medes and the Persians, against them. And they shall not regard silver, and as for gold, they shall not delight in it. They won't be able to be bought off. Many times when a nation was besieged, or a city was besieged, they could send out a gift of silver or gold to buy off the armies, to leave them alone. And that happened, for instance, with the Jews once, or Israel. Samaria bought off, I think it was the Assyrians, by sending them a gift on one occasion. But he says, these Medes, you're not going to be able to buy them off. They're not going to regard silver. They won't delight in gold. Their bows also shall dash the young men to pieces, and they shall have no pity on the fruit of the womb. And as the small babies, the Medes will have no compassion. Their eyes shall not spare children. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees, excellency, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. In other words, it'll be complete. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall the shepherds make their fold there, but wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures, and owls shall dwell there, and satyrs shall dance there, and the wild beasts of the island shall cry in their desolate houses, and dragons in their pleasant palaces, and her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged. What he's saying is that the city, once it's destroyed, will be permanently destroyed. No one will ever rebuild it. And in fact, the Arabians won't even pitch their tents there. Though Arabian Bedouins tend to wander about and pitch their tents wherever they want to, they will specifically avoid pitching their tents there. It will only be the haunt for desert wilderness animals. Now, it's an interesting thing that this has actually happened. Babylon was the chief city of the world, and it calls it the glory of kingdoms. And that is quite an accurate description of it at its highest point. It was certainly the glory of kingdoms. The Persians destroyed it completely, and it has never since been rebuilt. And we're talking about in over 2,500 years. No one has rebuilt it. Now, I heard that some engineers, some Americans, had planned to go and rebuild Babylon. I don't know why they want to do that, except just to, I guess, prove the prophecy's wrong. And I can't verify what I have to say, so don't, I mean, just take it with a grain of salt, but I've heard it from more than one source that there have been attempts made or plans made to rebuild Babylon, and those who were involved have experienced sudden deaths and things like that. So whether that's absolutely true or not, I can't verify, but I have heard that. And I'll guarantee you this, it won't be re-inhabited, it won't be rebuilt. And it says the Arabian won't pitch his tent there. It's an interesting fulfillment of that. To this day, 2,500 or more years later, the Arabians have superstitious views that the place is haunted, and they will not camp there. I mean, just as Isaiah predicted, the Arabians, who usually would pitch wherever they want to, you know, they avoid pitching their tent there because of the fear of spirits and so forth there. Well, let's go on to chapter 14 real quickly here. For the Lord will have mercy on Jacob. In other words, the reason he's going to judge Babylon is because Jacob, Israel, is going to be captive in Babylon. And by destroying Babylon, he's going to release Jacob to go back to his land. And I will yet choose Israel and set them in their own land. Now, this is not a reference to the church. This is a reference to the return from Babylon, obviously. You can tell by the context. And the strangers shall be joined with them, and they shall cleave to the house of Jacob. And the people shall take them and bring them to their place. And the house of Israel shall possess them in the land of the Lord for servants and for handmaids, and they shall take them captives, whose captives they were, and they shall rule over their oppressors. Now, what it's saying is, when God destroys Babylon and lets the Jews go back to their land, certain Gentiles will go along with them and will end up being servants of the Jews. And he speaks of this irony that those who had formerly been their captors will become their slaves or their captives. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord will give you rest from your sorrow and from thy fear and from the hard bondage wherein thou wast made to serve. That's addressed to Judah. But then we get back to Babylon in verse 4. That thou shalt take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say, how hath the oppressor ceased, the golden city ceased? The Lord hath broken the staff of the wicked and the scepter of the rulers. He who smote the people in wrath with a continual stroke, he that ruled the nations in anger, is persecuted, and none hindereth. The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into singing. In other words, everyone's relieved because Babylon has fallen, because Babylon was the oppressor of the whole world. When Babylon falls, everyone's going to rejoice. No one's going to be mourning for Babylon in this case. The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into singing. Yea, the fir trees rejoice at thee. The cedars of Lebanon, saying, since thou art laid down, no feller has come against us. In other words, a feller is someone to cut them down. Saying, essentially, now that Babylon's fallen, there's no one to oppress us anymore. It's said that the trees say that, but we know, of course, this would be really the sentiments of the people of those countries that are mentioned. Lebanon and so forth. Verse 9, hell from beneath, and we could also, that's of course Sheol in the Hebrew, it could be translated the grave. The grave or hell from beneath is moved for thee to meet thee at thy coming. It stirreth up the dead for thee, even all the chief ones of the earth. It hath raised up from their thrones all the kings of the nations. All they shall speak and say to thee, art thou also become weak as we? Art thou become like one of us? Thy pomp is brought down to the grave, and the noise of thy viols, which are musical instruments, the worm is spread under thee, and the worms cover thee. Death is the great equalizer. In life, Babylon had been the oppressor. It had been the strong one. It had oppressed other kings and other nations. It sent other kings to their doom. It, you know, Babylon, when it conquered nations, killed their kings, and their kings are now in the grave. Because guess what? You're going there too, and those kings, figuratively speaking, or maybe literally, who knows, but at least figuratively, if not literally also, those kings say, oh, now you're in the same condition we are. You're weak like we are too. You're mortal. Isn't that a shame? And, you know, how has the oppressor ceased? It's basically a lament, but it's also a taunt of the king of Babylon, that saying, oh, you who seem so strong, is it so that you're mortal too? Now you come to the grave like the rest of us. Then we have this interesting passage, verse 12. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend unto the heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell, to the sides of the pit. They that see thee shall narrowly look upon thee and consider thee, saying, is this the man that made the earth to tremble and did shake kingdoms, that made the world as a wilderness and destroyed the cities thereof, that opened not the house of his prisoners. All the kings of the nations, even all of them, lie in glory, everyone in his own house, that you are cast out of your grave like an abominable branch, and as the raiment of those that are slain, thrust through with the sword, that go down to the stones of the pit, as a carcass trodden under feet, thou shalt not be joined with them in burial, because thou hast destroyed thy land and slain thy people. The seed of evildoers shall never be renowned. And then it goes on. Now, let's talk about this passage a moment. Probably your ears perked up at verse 12 when it said, "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer?" If you have a modern translation, it probably doesn't say Lucifer. Some of them retain that translation, but the word Lucifer is just the Hebrew word that means bright, shining, or morning star. It has stumbled some people that Jesus is also called the bright morning star in the scripture, in Revelation. And yet here, it is obviously a wicked person who is called the bright morning star. Many modern translations have eliminated the name Lucifer altogether simply because it is the view of most scholars, and I think they're probably correct, that Lucifer is not to be understood as a proper name, but as a title. Many of us have heard that Lucifer refers to Satan, and that Lucifer was a great angel, one of the three top angels in heaven, along with Michael and Gabriel, and that he fell and led a third of the angels with him. It's exceedingly difficult to find scriptures to confirm that theory. For instance, there's no scripture in the whole Bible that speaks of a third of the angels falling. There is one place in Revelation 12 that speaks of the dragon drawing a third of the stars of heaven from heaven to earth, and that may be a reference to angels falling, but it doesn't seem to be in the context. Some think so, but if it is, it's the only place in the Bible that would suggest it. Although it's interesting how often people tell us that Satan is a fallen angel who drew a third of the angels with him without any scriptural support for that. Well, anyway, of course, many of the same people are quite sure that Lucifer in this passage is also a reference to Satan. Now you'd say, well, isn't Lucifer a standard name for the devil in the Bible? The answer is, if it is, we have no evidence of it, since this is the only place in the Bible that the name Lucifer appears. There's no other place in the whole Bible, and you may get your concordance to verify this if you wish, that the name Lucifer appears only here. So we can't, for instance, compare it with other scriptures and see whether it's a name for Satan. If it is, we have to find it in this passage. If we can't find it in this passage, then we have no scriptural reason to say that Lucifer is a name for Satan. Okay? Now let's look at the passage and see whether it is a reference to Satan. I mean, we should be able to tell. For one thing, I would say the context seems to militate against it. It's not a prophecy about... before and after it, it's very clearly a prophecy about Babylon, the fall of Babylon, and the king of Babylon. Verse 4 says, "You shall take up the proverb against the king of Babylon." Now, why would the king of Babylon be called, "O bright morning star," which is what Lucifer means? Probably because he was illustrious and glorious. And that's the same reason Jesus would be called the bright morning star, because he is too. You know, I might point out to you that Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar, you might remember Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylon. Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 2, "You, O king, are the king of kings." Now, that's interesting. He said to Nebuchadnezzar, "You are the king of kings." But isn't that also a title that is given to Christ in the Bible? But you see, king of kings is not a proper name. It is simply a description. A description of a ruler who rules over other kings. So bright and morning star might also be a general kind of a term for one who is illustrious and famous and powerful and bright and so forth. It's at least possible, which would explain why the same term could be applied to the king of Babylon and also to Christ. In a sense, king of Babylon was a king of kings. There were kings that he ruled over. In a sense, he was an illustrious bright morning star. At least so he viewed himself and his subjects viewed him. But in a far greater sense, Jesus is the true king of kings and the true bright morning star, and in a very universal sense that everyone must eventually acknowledge. The point here is that Lucifer needn't be seen as a proper name, and there's certainly nowhere else in the Bible that suggests that it is. And since the same reference, or the same idea of a bright morning star is applied to Jesus, it seems a bit awkward to say that Satan is the bright morning star. I mean, I've had people ask me that question, they were a bit stumbled, because they said, well, if Satan's the bright morning star, why is Jesus also said the bright morning star?
Can yeah.
It can be. It can be, very much so. In fact, in a similar passage in Ezekiel 28, I believe there's a tremendous amount of sarcasm in the prophecy that's spoken against the king of Tyre, and I'll demonstrate that when we have the opportunity. But, it's possible they say, "Oh, you bright morning star, look at you now. Look where you are now." But let's look at the passage itself. Is there some reason within the passage to suggest this is talking about an angel or an angelic being? First consideration is the context. I see nothing in the context to indicate that there's been a change of addressee. We know at verse 4, the person being addressed was the king of Babylon. Does verse 12 tell us that there's been a change? It does not tell us that. It might be that that's the case, and I couldn't say for sure that it isn't, but it doesn't appear to be. There's nothing in the passage to indicate it, so it would be only a guess if we said it is. Furthermore, what is said to Lucifer appeared to be said to a man and not an angel. Would you look, for instance, at verse 16? They that see thee shall narrowly look upon thee and say, is this the man that made the earth to tremble and did shake kingdoms? Sounds like something people might say to the king of Babylon when they see him reduced to impotence. And is this the man who is so haughty? But to say it about an angel, what if they say, is this that angelic being? But they call him a man. In verse 19, they say, you are cast out of your grave. It also says in the same verse 19, you are thrust through with the sword. In verse 20, it says, you shall not be joined with the others in burial. It seems to be speaking of a person who will have a disgraceful death and not be joined in burial with others. Furthermore, it does appear to be talking about something future. Because in verse 16 it says, they that see thee shall narrowly look upon thee. If this is talking about the fall of Satan, why would Isaiah speak of it as something still future when, by almost all, I don't know anyone who believes that Satan fell after Isaiah's time. Those who believe that Satan is a fallen angel would have to say he fell at least before he tempted Eve in the Garden of Eden. So it does not appear just from the verb tenses, from the fact that he's spoken of as a man, from the context that it's in within a prophecy against the king of Babylon, and there's no indication that there's been a change. It doesn't appear to be a prophecy about any supernatural being at all. But some will say, well, wait a minute, what about verse 13? Look at that. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. How could any earthly king say such things as that? Well, what was the origin of Babylon, if anyone remembers? The Tower of Babel. What was the ambition of those who built the Tower of Babel? We will ascend into heaven. We will rise above the stars. So like Khrushchev when he said, if there's a God up there, we're going to send our Sputnik up there, we're going to send our rockets up there, and if there's a God, we'll knock him off his throne. Well, somebody got knocked off his throne. It wasn't God. But it's that same kind of arrogance. They built the Tower of Babel. The beginning of Babylon was exactly this. I will exalt myself. I will ascend into heaven. Now, true, they may not have literally thought. It's hard to know how much they really thought they would go higher than the stars. We realize, of course, that in ancient times they had no idea how far the stars were. They may have really thought that the stars were close enough that they could maybe build a tower tall enough to do it. But whatever they thought, we know that this language applied to this person who's called Lucifer, or bright shining star, is very applicable to the very mentality of Babylon at its inception. And it speaks very plainly of the arrogance of Babylon. And especially when it says that I will sit, in verse 13, upon the mount of the congregation, on the sides of the north. I mean, if he's talking about usurping God's heavenly throne, what in the world does sides of the north mean, or the mount of the congregation, a mountain in heaven? It could easily apply to earthly figures of speech, but I personally don't see anything in the passage to suggest that this is talking about an angelic being. Now, if verse 13 still makes one think, well, you know, this language could not be made by earthly people, I will ascend above heaven and so forth, let me turn your attention to Jesus' words, because he borrows from this passage in one of his oracles in Matthew chapter 11. Matthew chapter 11, in verse 23, he's given an oracle and a burden against Capernaum, which was a physical city. It was not an angelic city. Capernaum was the city, in fact, where he had set up headquarters for his Galilean ministry. And Matthew 11, 23 says, thou Capernaum, which art exalted unto heaven, shalt be brought down to hell. Now, was Capernaum literally exalted unto heaven? And were they, as a city, literally brought down to hell? Well, we can't say whether or not that, whether they're in hell now today. I presume they are. But to say they were exalted, I mean they exalted themselves into heaven. He'll be brought down to hell. Isn't that really what is said to Lucifer here? You said, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. Yet, in verse 15, you shall be brought down to hell. The very thing that Jesus said about Capernaum is said about Lucifer. And since Capernaum is not a reference to any angelic being, then why should we say that the same statement, exact same statement made to Lucifer, must necessarily be made to an angelic being? So what I'm saying is this. I won't deny that Satan is a fallen angel. I don't know whether he is or not, but this passage doesn't say that he is. At least not clearly enough to me. I used to teach it until I found out that the early church didn't believe this was a reference to Satan. The first teacher in the church who ever believed that this was a reference to Satan was Tertullian. I don't remember which century he was. He was relatively early, I think 3rd century. But Tertullian is the one who originated the idea in the church that Lucifer referred to Satan. And it was also perpetuated by the first pope, whose name was Gregory the Great. And it was popularized in more recent times, still a few centuries back, by Milton in his book Paradise Lost. His poem Paradise Lost is really where the concept of Lucifer being Satan, a fallen angel, came from. It goes back to Tertullian. You can trace its history through Gregory the Great, and then finally to Milton. And of course, you'll find the radio preachers and TV preachers and popular preachers in general tend to take for granted that this is a reference to Satan. But I prefer not to take anything for granted. I'd like to see it in the Bible first, and I don't see it in this passage. And since Lucifer is not mentioned in any other passage, we're kind of left without a biblical witness to that point. You know, I mean, if we want to say that's Satan, you're welcome to the view, but you cannot exegetically find it in the Bible. Some will say, well, what about Ezekiel 28? Well, that's another issue, and if I had time, I'd love to go into it now, but we have to do that on another occasion. Let me just say about the rest of the passage in Isaiah 14, since we're out of time. He basically just continues to speak of the slaughter of the Babylonians at their fall. In verse 24, he says, "The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely as I have fought, so shall it come to pass, and as I have purposed, so shall it stand." In other words, God's purpose is going to come about, and Babylon can resist as much as they want to. They can't resist the purpose of God. In verse 27, he says, "For the Lord of hosts hath purposed, and who shall disannul it? His hand is stretched out, and who shall turn it back? In the year that King Ahaz died was this burden." Interesting that Isaiah got specific prophecies, particularly when kings died. Remember, it was the year that King Uzziah died that he saw the Lord high and lifted up in chapter 6. And then he gave a number of prophecies to King Ahaz, but when Ahaz died, then he had this burden of Babylon. And that's the end of the burden of Babylon, by the way. Except verse 29 and following gives a burden against the Philistines. And since it's so short, I'll just run through it without comment. "Rejoice not thou, whole Palestina," or Philistia, the Philistines country, "because the rod of him that smote thee is broken. For out of the serpent's root shall come forth a cockatrice, and his fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent. And the firstborn of the poor shall feed, and the needy shall lie down in safety. And I will kill thy root with famine, and he shall slay thy remnant. Howl, O gate, cry, O city, thou whole Palestina," or Philistia, "art dissolved. For there shall come forth from the north a smoke, and none shall be alone in his appointed times. What shall one then answer the messengers of the nation? The Lord has founded Zion, and the poor of his people shall trust in it." Essentially, the germ of this prophecy is this. The Philistines, who had been afflicted by Babylon, when they see the fall of Babylon, are told, don't rejoice. Even though your oppressor has fallen, don't get too happy yet. Because out of the egg of the serpent is going to come even a worse serpent, a cockatrice. And in other words, it may look like your enemy, the serpent Babylon, is dead, but a worse serpent is going to come against you and wipe you out. So the Philistines are not safe just because the Babylonians have fallen. I believe it was Alexander the Great who finally annihilated the Philistines. If it wasn't, it was the Romans. I'm not clear enough, I'm afraid, on the history of that to tell you. But one thing is for sure, before the time of Christ, the Philistines were no longer in existence. They were history. And so he's saying, just because Babylon falls doesn't mean security for the Philistines. They've got to take into consideration that God's going to judge them too. And he does. Well, we've run over, and so we'll quit at that point. Are there any questions?